we stopped at this, what's called the teepee anchorage, the southern end of Colross Island, where we take people ashore, kayakers camp. A lot of people use that beach area. And on the east-facing side, all the pebbles and cobbles look like they're in an emulsion of brown glue. They sort of sticky. It is awful. It's indescribably horrible. And I don't know how one cleans this kind of stuff off a beach.
But the other side of the same beach was unoiled. And as they went deeper into Port Nellie 1, they found the oil hadn't reached that far.
That's the most wonderful thing. We had many, many, many anxious hours in Valdez, watching the reports come in every day, going to pick up the maps to find out how much of the Nellie 1 area, how much of was being exposed to oil. And not a bit of oil was there. We sailed up to Nellie 1 Glacier. We anchored up there. I took my kayak. I scoured the shoreline. I looked underneath rockweed. I looked underneath rocks. I walked the beaches. I dug down in the gravels, and I didn't see one speck of oil anyplace. I can't tell you how absolutely happy I was, and it was pouring rain.
Lefko said wildlife was plentiful in the area, but tourists were not. It's going to take some effort, she says, to get the word out about post-spill cruising in the Sound. The northern and western parts are okay, and so is the eastern Sound. Much of it planned for logging in the future, but for now, impressive country. The problem for the Lefkos was how to get from one side to the other. They needed an anchorage in the middle. In the past, they'd used a harbor on Naked Island, one of the first areas to be hit by the oil.
Bass Harbor is on the southern side of Naked Island. We use it in our charter business a lot as an anchorage. We went back to it and were delighted to find that the oil at that point apparently was a consistency that it did not stick to the shoreline that much. We spent 3 or 4 hours on the beach, and I did find some areas that were oiled. We had to hunt for it, and we were hunting for it because it's a concern to us.
Other charter operators are also trying to get the word out that it's still possible to cruise Prince William Sound and not be swimming in oil. The same applies to other areas as well. Kenai Fjords Tours says most of the places they go for wildlife viewing are unchanged, but business is slow this summer. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel. Walt Parker will chair the commission, and he'll try to steer the investigation into waters he's been through before. He was in charge of developing the state's tanker policy in the pipeline days. And if those recommendations had been followed, the Exxon Valdez hull would have been stronger, and a pilot would have been on the bridge. Parker says there's a lot to investigate, and they'll try to make maximum use of what's already been put on the record.
We'll be more a user of information than a generator of information. We have neither the time or resources to generate much primary research information.
The commission does, however, have subpoena power. Meetings continue today. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel. The seven commissioners are for the most part hard-boiled veterans of Alaska resource conflicts, and that's certainly true of Chairman Walt Parker.
I chaired the Oil Tanker Vessel Standard Task Force for Governor Hammond from 1975 through 1976, where we worked on a lot of these issues.
What Parker and the state wanted were double-hull tankers, pilots aboard all the way from Hinchinbrook Entrance to Port Valdez, and adequate spill handling capacity. All of that was gradually eroded over the years, and the result was a tanker grounded without a pilot on the bridge and a spill completely out of control. The commission will start by developing its own interpretation of the existing record, but does have the power to subpoena records and witnesses. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The biggest problem is at the Kanakanak Hospital near Dillingham, where diesel fuel recently washed onto a nearby beach. Concerns about the diesel-soaked soil surrounding the hospital have been known for years, even decades according to some. A makeshift separation tank has been used to skim the oil from the drains beneath the hospital. But the system was overwhelmed in recent heavy rain, sending oil pouring onto a nearby beach used by subsistence fishermen. Those drains have now been plugged, and Department of Environmental Conservation Inspector Mike Lewis says the Indian Health Service has agreed to clean up the mess. First, however, they have to evaluate the site, determine the extent of the spill, and figure out a way to clean it up. Right now, Lewis says they don't even know where the oil is coming from. He does guess that the amount involved is substantial and that the cleanup could take years. And it's not the only spill in the Bristol Bay region. In fact, there were three others reported this week alone. The cleanup is underway of about 200 gallons of diesel spilled by a contractor into a creek near Dillingham. Near Naknek, there are reports of bunker oil leaking from a wooden tank at a cannery, and Aleknagik residents complained about an oil sheen coming from a derelict barge. Taking a slightly wider look, two oil spills are under investigation at the Adak Navy Base. There was a significant spill earlier this year at the Cape Newenham radar site. The cleanup of a large underground leak at a Togiak cannery is underway. A grounded cargo ship near Dutch Harbor spilled tens of thousands of gallons of oil near the Aleutian port in February. Several other vessel groundings over the winter threatened the shorelines of the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands with oil. Even without the Exxon Valdez, 1989 is shaped up to be an extraordinary year for oil spills, at least in southwest Alaska. Noting the seriousness of many of them, the DEC's Mike Lewis says the reports aren't just due to a heightened sensitivity to contamination following the Exxon spill, but he is glad that increased sensitivity to DEC's budget needs has at least allowed them to deal with the problem. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
The United States considered purchasing such a vessel in the early 70s. It was finally determined that either that it wouldn't be necessary or it just would cost too much. So we're in a situation now, Madam Chair, where we are producing as much oil as anybody in the Arctic. We have no way to respond to a spill that size. We don't have any way to clean it up.
What it would do, it would allow a lot of Alaskans who want to get involved, have the equipment, to get involved in a meaningful way. And the evidence that we've seen from this particular activity early in the spill has been very, very significant. They picked up an awful lot of oil.
Somebody's got to be put in charge of a spill that large immediately. We had a jurisdictional question right after the spill. By federal law, the industry had the right to respond first. They did not do so. Later, we asked the Coast Guard to take charge. They had the right to do so, but they didn't want to do it right off. In my opinion, Madam Chair, without going on too much with that, U.S. Coast Guard should be designated as the acting authority to take charge of a spill of this magnitude.
Similar to what we used to do when we had the fish buying station. We'd have a fish buying barge in a cove, and the individual fisherman would just go in and sell. In this case, he'd be picking up oil off the beach, moose and whatever, and he would just simply sell the bags by weight or by volume to Exxon and get paid for it.
Kenai Peninsula residents drove home the message to Coast Guard Commandant Paul Yost last week. They felt the peninsula was being overlooked by Exxon and the Coast Guard and not being given the attention it deserved. Yost met with Robbins and suggested the Vice Admiral come over to Homer and get a first-hand look at what is going on. Robbins has spent the past 2 days on the beaches along the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula that have been hit hard by oil, and sat in on a meeting of the local oil spill response team. So far, only shovels, rakes, and absorbent material have been used to clean up the oil. The Vice Admiral says it's time for Exxon to consider other, more intensive cleanup methods.
What we will be doing is using a lot of hand wands with hot water and trying to absorb the oil as it comes off, rather than trying to float it in mass down into the water areas and try to catch it before it gets into other areas. We will, we're even probably going to try some turning of the soil where in the right location where it will expose the oil that's buried deeper, and we will then decide how we're going to treat that further. We may want to wash it out of the turned soil. We may want to let it biodegrade. It just depends on the conditions we find as we do these things.
Robin said some chemicals are being tested in Valdez that might help clean up the oil. At this time, he said nothing has been approved, but the Coast Guard and Exxon are still hoping that something along those lines can be used. The other major problem that was brought to Robin's attention was an organizational logjam. This week, the working relationship between Exxon and the state and federal agencies reached an all-time low. Harsh words were traded back and forth at a meeting on Monday that was abruptly canceled. There was no meeting Tuesday, but Wednesday, Robbins told everyone he wants to see a more cooperative effort.
I need to have a better structure in the organization so that decisions that are made come through the federal on-scene coordinator so that we are not starting and stopping operations out in the field. I can't have individual agencies reacting directly with Exxon and giving stop orders and start orders and that sort of thing. So the way I hope that what will come out of this is we'll end up with an organization where the state will be represented, the state organizations will be represented by ADEC. That's their job. They are the state on-scene coordinator.
Robbins said he plans to make regular visits to Homer to make sure that the orders he has given are being followed. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
These are tough jobs, and we really need for people to be alert and on top of everything in those jobs. So it's a safety issue more than a drug issue.
They want everything to come back and go through a debate with Exxon. And always it leaves a bad taste in the community's mouths. And it doesn't feel good to always go to Exxon and say, may we put an extra police officer on? May we put someone down at the port because we've got a problem? Those are the kinds of questions, and they want us to come back and say, may we? And we're saying, hey, how about telling us ahead of time those items that you can cover, and then we won't have to say may we for those.
These are tough jobs, and we really need for people to be alert and on top of everything in those jobs. So it's a safety issue more than a drug issue.
They want everything to come back and go through a debate with Exxon. And always it leaves a bad taste in the community's mouths. And it doesn't feel good to always go to Exxon and say, may we put an extra police officer on? May we put someone down at the port because we've got a problem? Those are the kinds of questions, and they want us to come back and say, may we? And we're saying, hey, how about telling us ahead of time those items that you can cover, and then we won't have to say may we for those.
And in hindsight, looking at it, we probably shouldn't have stopped it at that time. We probably should have continued it. I don't think we have a lot of people on drugs. I think it's a very, very small percentage, but it is a critical safety issue.
Dr. John French of the Fisheries Industrial Technology Center says oil will sink if it gets back into the water after hitting a beach. When tar balls or moose hit a beach, the weathered oil picks up a significant amount of gravel.
And in the case of our observations, even in some of the oils that have been retrieved from the water, while we're getting gravels up to about pea size, this very easily increases the density up to the buoyant density, and therefore drops it subsurface.
In some cases, the oil sinks to the bottom and goes into the sediments. In other cases, it'll just roll around in the water. French says come summer, when the temperature rises, the gravelly moose will break up, and because of the wave action in high-energy beaches, the oil will eventually stabilize as broken droplets, measuring roughly a tenth of a millimeter.
These are obviously not going to be easily seen or cleaned up. So there is the potential, as we get oil coming off of weathered high-energy beaches in weathered form, that we're going to be creating more subsurface and more oil in the sediments.
French says this creates two problems. One, it's harder to predict the location of oil because it can't be seen on the surface. And the other problem, as more oil is released into the water column, there's an increased chance of exposure to the free-swimming organisms.
Obviously, the best solution is not to let weathered oil get back off the beaches, to clean it up as promptly as possible. We've all been pushing for that all along anyway. But I think that the experience, especially with gravel and sand beaches and the higher energy beaches, is that it's really important that as it's washing off, we probably aren't seeing all the oil being refloated.
Dr. John French of the Fisheries Industrial Technology Center. French's comments at Friday's oil spill meeting increased the sense of urgency to get oil off the beaches.
Senator McCaskey a week ago brought up the bounty bag system. It could only mean that it would be more people out picking up more oil. And isn't that the name of the game here?
Tricia Gartland asked Exxon representative John Peavy if the Bounty system will be set up in Kodiak. Peavy had no definitive answer, but said he'd look into it. In the meantime, Exxon is organizing more beach cleanup crews. There are 7 25-person crews currently working Kodiak and Katmai. Peavy says they'll hire 3 more crews within the next few days. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent. The Smallwood fire spits and fizzles.
It's smoky. I know. That fire trying to keep this place warm a little bit.
The Norcon worker from Fairbanks has lived in this camp for 6 weeks.
Yeah, this guy that was living here, he was living in his car. Now, he got a chance to stay at Norcon camp tonight. Just they had room enough for 50 of them tonight. And now we're going to get a chance to, if we want to move into the camper, get $35 a day. I'm going to take the 35. So we're going to get a deal.
While this anonymous worker says he likes where he's living, others, such as carpenter Dan Elliott, were furious that many Norcon union workers were living in cars and trucks, unable to find decent housing, while the non-union VECO workers and Exxon employees were staying in hotels and organized camps, eating hot meals and taking showers.
As far as living conditions, you wait in line to go to the phone, you wait in line to take a crap, you wait in line to take a shower, and what else is there? You pay $2 for a loaf of bread.
Exxon has hired through VECO, Norcon, and other subcontractors more than 9,300 workers. That number includes thousands of people that are living on boats in Prince William Sound or are based in Kodiak, Homer, and other locations. But Valdez officials say there are now about 10,000 people living in the city, up from the normal population of 3,200. According to Norcon's Director of Labor Relations, Exxon does not have to provide housing or food. Gary Bacon says the labor contract is an Alyeska pipeline maintenance agreement signed long before the Exxon Valdez spilled her oil into Prince William Sound.
It is very unusual to deviate from a contract because that's what contracts are for. You abide by the contract and that's how you function.
Any reason why do you think that this came about?
Yes, I think that a need was seen by Exxon and they realized that the amount of pressure that was being put on the city of Valdez by the people in the area living in substandard conditions, they realized that something needed to be done, and they moved to accomplish that.
Exxon's top man in Valdez, Otto Harrison, said the company didn't know that hundreds of Norcon laborers were working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week and were homeless. Harrison said that's because many of those workers had listed Valdez as their residence.
So we didn't have an adequate count initially, whether they be VECO or Norcon, on people who had signed up as residents but were not actually residents, so therefore didn't have housing. In the process of following that up, we're getting some numbers on that, but I don't have them right now. Whether that was disproportionately Norcon versus VECO or not, I don't know.
So you were unaware that people that were working were actually not living in houses or tents or were living in cars? And
that is correct.
Harrison says the discrepancy in the figures that Exxon has for housing versus the numbers of people working on shore in Valdez is because the totals include those workers with Valdez addresses and those who choose to live in recreational vehicles or other housing. Life in some RVs can be very comfortable, but many people are crammed into campers. Last month, one family of 5 tried unsuccessfully to live in a 21-foot camper. 27-year-old Lisa Bridges, pregnant with her 4th child, says she didn't want the family to be apart. While her husband worked for Norcon, she took care of the kids. Bridges said she spent more than $800 for water, sewer, electricity, and phone hookups.
Part of our biggest hardship has been watching, you know, all the men my husband works with and all of our friends, you know, live like dogs.
As she peeled carrots, Bridges broke down.
The night before, you know, I had to go give my kids cold showers and listen to them scream. Anyways, you know, well, if you don't like it, why don't you just go home? And then I'm not just talking for me. It's just there's a lot of families. And we were going to have to be apart the rest of summer, you know, for a while this summer anyway. And so our point was to try to be together because it's hard on all of us being apart.
Bridges took the children back to Anchorage. The father remained in Valdez. Modular housing units have been under construction for weeks. Valdez City Manager Doug Griffin says there were delays and problems that stemmed from Vico's haste to erect the temporary structures.
I think there was a feeling on the part of some of Exxon's subcontractors that the speed of getting something up was paramount, and they did not come in and get the proper permits and have the inspections, and so really left us no choice but to red tag them to sort of get their attention and say, you've got to come by, we've got to do it by the book. In our haste to try to get this housing up, we don't want to create an unsafe situation.
Of the 1,300 beds Exxon says will be available, 130 are already for Norcon workers. Gary Bacon says the foreman and shop stewards made up a list of those who needed the housing the most.
The individuals that were sick, the individuals that were staying in cars, sleeping in tents, sleeping in the back of a truck under Visqueen and that sort of thing. At this particular point in time, we feel that has been alleviated. I am sure that a number of our people that are still not living in camp will do so. However, at this particular time, the needy, those individuals that everyone was really concerned about, have been put into camp housing.
But still, there are other workers, the unemployed, and the cannery workers who live in tents and cars scattered throughout Valdez. At the local hospital, doctors and nurses have been dealing with the tremendous influx of workers suffering from pneumonia, bronchitis, and strep throat. Hospital Administrator Joy Keating says it was mostly laborers who were ill.
I think that it's reasonable to say that we saw more of it due to the way people were living. We had several people complain that their urinary tract infections were attributable to the fact that they didn't have a place to go to the bathroom and they weren't going as often as they should. So that has come up also. I think for a while there, it seemed like everyone that came in was Norcon and they all had a real serious bronchitis, and so we sort of were identifying that with Norcon. But I haven't checked the numbers to see a total whether we've had actually more Norcon people than Vico, but certainly it has been more laborers.
The living conditions in Valdez could present another potentially critical problem that is worrying health and city officials.
We have a fear. There are areas that you can smell the raw sewage, areas that we know, there's a substantial amount just being dumped on the ground. And that is at risk for typhoid. And that is a concern. And we are looking at that very closely. And public health is looking at it.
Mayor John Devens warned City Council that contagious diseases would devastate not only the local population, but also send a tremor through the tourist industry.
When we drove in today, I smelled that when we went through there, and I didn't know what it was, but I smelled it. And if that is the sewerage that's coming off of those campers that are out there,
not all of them, friends,
we have got a serious health problem in this community. And I'll tell you, if a disease breaks out there, you can kiss tourism goodbye for a long time. And I think we've got to be looking at that, and somehow I think we need some additional reserves there.
Exxon has given the city more than $300,000 to buy portable showers, toilets, and develop water and sewer lines for RVs and tent platforms on city property. Exxon's Otto Harrison says there's still work that needs to be done.
At this point, we're still short some housing, and as you saw when we were out visiting today, we're still building some. At the time that all is completed that you saw today, we will have adequate housing for everything that we have in town at this moment.
For APRN, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez.
Hazelwood's trial date and time remain the same, the 20th of June in Valdez, for trial on these more serious charges. The former Exxon Valdez master was originally to face 3 misdemeanor charges, but since then a grand jury has indicted him for 3 counts of second-degree criminal mischief. His attorneys have still not filed a motion for change of venue, though they've said they intend to. They did file a motion for a continuance that would delay the trial date. Hazelwood's bail will remain the same. The judge, at least for now, is Superior Court Justice John Bossert in Valdez. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
An angry, frustrated crowd left Fisherman's Hall Saturday. Exxon community liaison John Peavy came without the promised preseason agreement. But Peavy said Exxon has a sincere appreciation of the problems facing the fishing communities. Peavy said representatives from Kodiak, Cordova, Homer, and Cook Inlet will meet with Exxon in Anchorage Tuesday to come up with a final plan.
The purpose of that meeting, obviously, is to come to some understanding as to what the problem is, what impacts there are, and what the differences are of opinions of what the fishing community think should Exxon should provide to keep them in a situation of guarantees, and also what Exxon's position is on it. So I think Tuesday should give everyone a pretty good indication after the Tuesday meeting of what's going to happen.
An issue causing grave concern among Kodiak fishermen was Exxon's plans to dispose of contaminated fish. Peavy said dirty fish tenders will collect and weigh oiled salmon. Then the fish will be sent to grinder vessels and dumped 3 miles out at sea. Since dumping oil is strictly prohibited, fishermen asked how oiled fish could be put back into the water. New sightings by test fisheries through June 10th showed oil all along both sides of Kodiak Island. When asked about determining openings and closures, ADF&G's Larry Nicholson said the department will err on the conservative side.
If we see oil sheen in an area and there's a likelihood that that sheen can move down to an area below it, either through wind or currents, that area in conjunction is going to be closed. If there is a postage stamp of oil out there and all the adjacent beaches are contaminated or a portion of them are contaminated and there's a likelihood that that oil can refloat and move back out, that area is going to be closed. It's going to be that cut and dry. But if the beaches are in good shape and we see one little patch of oil and we've had ideal conditions to go out and survey that area, which is flat, calm conditions, and we've been able to mobilize a real effort, we may have a limited fishery in that area.
Due to the amount of new oil sightings, and since Exxon still has not come through with any preseason guarantees for fishermen, the task force voted to close the salmon season until the 23rd. ADF&G will announce on June 14th whether they intend to proceed with the scheduled opening on the 16th. Task Force member Linda Kozak asked Exxon rep John Peavy if Tuesday would be the magic day when a preseason agreement would finally be in hand.
And my question now is, are we going to face another delay, or can you guarantee us that on this Tuesday when the fishermen's group meet with Exxon that we'll have something as a result of that?
I'm not going to sit here and guarantee you what the outcome of the Tuesday meeting is going to be, no. I hope so, but I'm not going to sit here and guarantee something I can't deliver.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Money is making a difference in researching the oil spill, and the university wants its share. It also wants its share of the credit for research already done on the spill and on Prince William Sound. Stephen McLean of the Institute of Arctic Biology told the Regents about proposals from the university that are being taken over by federal agencies, who aren't even mentioning the university as the source of those ideas.
The University of Alaska is the major contributor to this research, and yet anyone who would pick up this document will say, well, why isn't the university contributing to this process?
McLean is blaming the trustee agencies for a federal project called CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. The act was passed so government agencies could assess the financial damages to get them from the perpetrator, in this case, Exxon. McLean says the trustees have a legal role, not a scientific one. These agencies aren't interested in taking samples, but in collecting evidence. CERCLA trustees are the Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, and the Forest Service. At a recent meeting of CERCLA trustees, the university put forth many proposals for studies.
Well, one thing we found was that wherever there was overlap between a study proposed by University of Alaska and a study proposed by a trustee agency, that overlap was resolved in favor of the trustee agency.
Regents were disturbed when McLean said one federal agency using a University of Alaska proposal is planning on importing a biologist from Oregon instead of using the 20 years of research already accumulated by oceanographers here. And one regent was outraged to find out Exxon has talked with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts about funding their research on the Valdez oil spill. Eric Forer of Juneau put forward the motion to lasso some of the money heading toward what he called the Eastern Establishment. He suggested Exxon endow a chair for the University of Alaska. The motion was quickly seconded, but then changed to eliminate what other regents thought was derogatory language. The regents voted to ask Exxon and other corporations to fund its research projects and to compete with federal agencies for the same research dollars. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
The last time Hazelwood stood in an Anchorage courtroom, he was facing less serious charges. Now they're felonies, carrying as much as a 10-year jail term if the state can convince a jury he's guilty of second-degree criminal mischief for allowing the Exxon Valdez to impale itself on a well-marked navigation hazard and cause an oil spill that's already cost more than $200 million to deal with. Hazelwood's bail is the same as before, $50,000, and for now his trial date's the same, though his lawyers have filed for a continuance and say they'll try to get the trial moved from Valdez. District Attorney Brent Cole says the state will oppose a change of venue. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel. The three counts of criminal mischief against Joe Hazelwood could net him as much as 10 years in jail. District Attorney Brent Cole says each carries a maximum 5 years, but they're structured in such a way that he couldn't be convicted of all three. They're far more serious than the misdemeanor charges he'd been arraigned on earlier, though they could have put him away for a couple of years. Hazelwood's Alaska attorney Dick Madsen has filed for a continuance, so a trial date of June 20th will probably slip. For now, it's assigned to Valdez judge John Bossert, though Madsen has said he'll try to move the trial from Valdez. Cole says the state would oppose that. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The purpose of that meeting, obviously, is to come to some understanding as to what the problem is, what impacts there are, and what the differences are of opinions of what the fishing communities think should Exxon should provide to keep them in a situation of guarantees.
The so-called oiled mayors are looking for money up front to pay for oil-related expenses and compensation for employees diverted to oil spill work. Both are important to them because they give them flexibility to deal with oil impacts at once without worrying about how they're going to get the money back. Exxon has said it wants the same thing, but when it came time to sign the latest version of the contract the mayors drew up, the company balked. Kodiak Mayor Bob Brody chairs the mayor's task force.
We had taken Exxon at their word a week ago in regard to the state agreement that they were using as a model for what we should come up with. We took that agreement, scratched out state, wrote in municipality, and then put in a paragraph based upon what we thought we heard them say regarding straight time reimbursement and forward funding of municipal needs, and tried to write down what we thought we heard them say. We sent that to them a week ago. When we met Monday, they handed us a draft proposal that did not reflect what we had sent them in the least, in our opinion. Three-quarters of the text had been changed, entire portions deleted. So, I mean, it really came as a disappointment to us that we could have so misunderstood what they wanted.
Brody says he tried to keep quiet about the meeting in hopes Exxon would see the light, but that hasn't happened. The oiled mayors meet Thursday to map out their next move. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Fisherman Dave Harville is just one of many who've expressed concern about dumping oiled fish offshore. But Harville is more than just concerned. He threatens to go to court if DEC goes ahead with the plan.
We have a couple of very healthy fisheries here in town that so far haven't been impacted. The halibut fishery, which is being prosecuted right now, the black cod fishery, which is just over with, and the groundfish fishery, which is ongoing. And we're fishing the bottom of the ocean from 10 fathoms to 350 fathoms. And I can guarantee to the ADEC or to the state of Alaska or to Exxon that if any attempt is made to take something which is so bad that you can't put it into the food chain and take it out and dump it and throw it back into the food chain, I will personally file an injunction and try to stop it.
Harville says it doesn't make sense that DEC normally issues tickets to canneries for dumping fish waste, and now it intends to authorize dumping tainted fish waste. But ADF&G biologist Dana Schmidt says waste disposed by canneries far exceeds the amount of contaminated fish the DEC plans to dispose. DEC and ADF&G expect very little volume of fish will actually have to be dumped.
The concern of having roiled fish recycled back in the environment and somehow the oil contaminating other food is, it's got a lot of people concerned, but there's a few things that will certainly at least mitigate this concern. One is they are going to deposit them offshore quite a ways away from any of the coastal areas. And secondly, we don't anticipate having any significant volume at all. The Fish and Game Department, in concert with DEC, is going to take very conservative actions in closing fisheries so we don't have large volumes of waste. We're charged with preventing waste, and the amount of fish that we'll end up with to actually grind and process, we hope will be zero.
Schmidt says ADF&G will not allow a fishery to continue if large amounts of contaminated fish are caught. If there's any oil in a catch, the entire load of fish will be condemned, which means much of the ground-up fish should have extremely small concentrations of oil residue on them.
Have to think of a large volume of oil floating around out in the water right now from the spill that's covered the entire Gulf. And if you think about it, if that's being attached to a fish, a very tiny amount could be attached to any fish. And then that fish being ground and deposited isn't going to contaminate the product of animal feeding out there. It's just going to be such a slight amount that it's going to be trivial compared to the amount that's out there from the oil spill originally.
Though neither DEC nor ADF&G expect any problems with oiled fish dumping, the plan is being reevaluated. Kodiak's Emergency Council mentioned the fishermen's concerns to Vice Admiral Robbins, and Robbins promised to discuss the matter with the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Our whole intention was to get an agreement that would better enable us to clean up the oil and deal with the problems on our shores. And I guess we're just going to have to do the best we can without Exxon.
Advanced Environmental Technology Incorporated of Louisiana was quick to approach Exxon once its spill began to hit beaches. And the company's the only one of many who are trying who have actually got the company's signature on a contract. Now all they have to do is get the incinerator to work. A large AET incinerator is about to be barged up from Seattle. The company says it will burn the waste clean. State officials view those claims with some skepticism and say, show me. So far, the company has no permit. Other waste-burning efforts are faltering. Sealy Sawmill's floating incinerator plan has been deep-sixed by public opposition. Whittier City Incinerator has soil test problems. And the Valdez City Council is threatening to shut down three incinerators too small to be regulated by the state. And the oily waste just keeps on piling up. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
There's strength in unity, and the mayors are still very united. The mayors are going to meet Thursday and look at this counterproposal. We're going to responsibly examine it, but at this point, it doesn't meet any of the needs that we feel are essential to us.
The latest incinerator was trucked in parts to Seattle and has been mounted on a barge to float up to Alaska. Owned by a Louisiana company named Advanced Environmental Technology, can burn 2 to 5 tons an hour and is fitted with what EPA Inspector Mark Hooper calls an extensive containment system. If it works right, he says, it ought to be clean. But that's the hitch. Opponents of burning the waste say incinerators usually don't work right, and the amount of waste Exxon is generating as thousands pick up oiled material could lead to substantial emissions. Citizens evidently agree they've blocked all efforts to fire up another floating incinerator off the shores of their towns. The AET furnace is due to leave Seattle tonight or tomorrow. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
They had been quoted as saying that they would do what was necessary to make us fiscally whole. And those were their words. And we even had those words in the document. And on the advice of their attorney, they deleted those words, saying that, well, maybe we shouldn't sign that.
There's the one school of thought that's going to say that it is oil, and there's the other school of thought that says it isn't oil. And until they can do their tests, it's really hard to say.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced Thursday the season is postponed again due to oil-contaminated waters. Also, because of the previous season cancellation on June 9th, many management questions exist regarding the strength of the Kodiak salmon runs. At Wednesday night's
Salmon Task Force meeting, many people were anxious to hear news of a pre-season fishing agreement with Exxon. Fishermen from Kodiak, Homer, Prince William Sound, and Cook Inlet met with Exxon representatives in Anchorage on Tuesday. To the crowd's disappointment, no information on pre-season guarantees was revealed. Jeff Stevens, speaking on behalf of the Kodiak Task Force, said they had been advised by private attorneys not to discuss any negotiations except with salmon permit holders. When pressed, Stephen did say no pre-season agreement was in hand, but he was optimistic one was forthcoming. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Seven gray whales washed up on Tagetik and Sitkanak Islands just south of Kodiak. Three other grays have been found on Kodiak Island proper at Karluk, Passagshaak, and Cape Chiniak. Scientists took tissue samples from some of the whales and are still waiting for results. In the meantime, few are willing to speculate on the cause of death.
It's hard to speculate on. You know, there's always two schools of thought. You know, there's the one school of thought that's going to say that it is oil, and there's the other school of thought that says it isn't oil. And until they can do their tests, it's really hard to say. And there's good arguments both ways.
John Cook of the National Marine Fisheries Service says there's not necessarily a marked increase of dead whales. There's a marked increase in reports of dead whales.
We've generally been the one to find whales, unless they're right around town. If they're around town, we hear about them. You know, somebody will report them. Whales that beach down on Tagetik, Sitkanak, down on the Alatak Peninsula, we might be out on a flight or on a surface patrol and we see it, we go down and do the stuff. Well, that's, you know, there's only five guys in this office. Now all of a sudden there's hundreds of boats out there, you know, and everybody's reporting everything. So whether it's a marked increase or whether it's just a lot of eyes out there, it's hard to say.
Aside from the confirmed deaths, some people describe seeing whales roll around as if they were sick. Cook says he hasn't found any sick whales yet, but if people have seen whales rolling around, there may be an explanation.
And I don't know. They may be sick or they may not, because I haven't seen them. But I also know that whales come into the gravel area, especially grays, and they clean their bodies. They'll get these barnacles and stuff on them. Well, they go in the gravel and they'll roll in that gravel and like a sandpaper to them, and it'll scrape a lot of those barnacles and clean their skin and itch and rub. And when I was down at Passagshaak, if you look at the beach, it's the ideal type of spot for gray whales to be in cleaning, and it's quite possible that it's a cleaning station. Then again, it could be a sick whale.
Kodiak's National Marine Fisheries Office will continue studying the whale carcasses, but with only five people on staff, they need help. Cook says it takes a team of at least seven people to perform one whale autopsy in a timely manner. So they're putting together a whale response team and asking for volunteers. No special experience required.
We would prefer somebody that has, you know, some animal background of some sort, but basically, you know, if a person's gutted deer and cleaned deer and that type of stuff, you know, you'd have, as far as I'm concerned, experience. It basically amounts to taking the blubber off the whales and, opening up the rib cages and letting the pathologist, you know, opening up a path for them to get in and do what they need to do.
Volunteers will be provided with equipment and travel from Kodiak to the whale sites. Out-of-towners need to provide their own transportation to Kodiak. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Three congressmen and six aides are due to arrive in Valdez on Friday. Then next week, they'll be followed by 12 congressmen and 30 of their aides. What they'll see are miles of oiled beaches, salmon fisheries closed or delayed, and a governor wondering if it isn't time for the state to do what it can to get more oil picked up more quickly. During a visit to the Kenai Peninsula town of Port Graham on Wednesday, Governor Cooper heard what's now a standard complaint among communities hit by the oil spill. That is, Exxon is not doing enough to get the oil cleaned up, especially outside of Prince William Sound. The Coast Guard reports just 200 or so workers assigned to some 175 miles of beaches on the outside coast of the Kenai Peninsula. The problem, according to Exxon, is there's just not enough vessels to handle more workers right now. But Port Graham residents told Cooper that they'll pitch in if the state is willing to help fund and coordinate their efforts. And Cooper said he's been thinking about that for some time now. The problem, says the governor, is a legal one. The Attorney General's office says that any independent effort by the state could give Exxon a good argument in court not to pay for those costs. But the governor does have some $35 million at his disposal for the cleanup effort, and sometime soon he may decide that preventing further environmental damage from the oil spill is more important than the threat of losing a legal argument in the courts. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
I'm shutting down their system, all their computers, all their data collection. NOAA, the Coast Guard, Exxon, VECO, NORCON, their connection with vessels out at sea, computer-wise, and their connection with Houston, Texas.
Ray Monegold is employed by Exxon as a computer consultant. He says he quit working for Exxon twice before just so he could get paid.
I'm starting to get up to the point where I need another paycheck. This time, when I realized that I'd have to quit to get money, a sense of fairness came over me, and I realized that if I'm quitting and shutting down all their computer systems so that just I can get money, it's not right. Not just I will get my money, but every merchant in this town can get his money or her money. Every vendor, every boat owner, every crew member who hasn't been paid. And that's my ultimatum. That's the only condition under which I will turn this system back on.
Monegold says Exxon could spend all their time, money, and energy putting in a new system, but instead he hopes they'll devote their energy to putting in an efficient payment system. Monegold's gripe is really with VECO. He says the company chose not to use a computer program he designed that would have improved the payment system.
I set about finding what it would take to make a smooth, easy, available payment system for a vendor. And with the support of Exxon and the encouragement of an outside source, I designed and installed that system, and it was, in fact, online for a couple of days. However, the people at VECO chose to close it down, and now they only use a small part of it. But when the system was online, a request could be made for service or materials, and within that same day, provided all the vendors' paperwork was submitted properly, a check could have been cut.
But Exxon's Director of Operations in Kodiak, Wayne Fordham, says payment to vendors and workers is not a simple process in such a large operation. He says Exxon and VECO are actively working on the problem. Fordham expects VECO to straighten out the payment system within a few days. As for the computer shutdown, Fordham says he doesn't think Monegold acted maliciously. Fordham doubts Exxon will press charges. Exxon hopes to work things out amicably with Monegold and get the system back online. The computer is used to track a wealth of information, including vessel locations, equipment inventory, air operations, and beach assessments, also VECO personnel hours, the pollution report, and fish and wildlife reports. Fordham says the lack of a functioning computer system will not suspend operations, but it will create more inefficiency. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The Department of Environmental Conservation has always been a poor relative of many of the popular, well-endowed state agencies that sport budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars and hand out prized grants and entitlements to local communities. DEC is one of the watchdog agencies, the folks who tell you that you can't do that without a permit. You're messing up that stream or drinking water supply, or your fish aren't good enough to sell. Many Alaskans and quite a few of their elected representatives spend a good deal of time complaining about DEC and guarding against all but the most critical increases in the agency's $18 million budget. More than 2 months after the Valdez oil spill, interviews with DEC officials suggest an agency that has always been stretched thin is now almost invisible in some areas. Air quality is one hard-hit function. DEC's Len Varelli says his section has lost a lot of people to Valdez, largely because of the controversy over the burning of oily waste. The ongoing projects, like processing intricate permits for development projects that could affect air quality, is falling behind schedule. Dina Hankins in the Wastewater and Water Treatment section says the regional staff are falling behind on their plan reviews for new water projects, an important data entry work that enables DEC to monitor thousands of public water systems is backlogged. Over in Hazardous and Solid Waste Management, David DeTroyo says a lot of staff have been siphoned off to Valdez. With a staff of just 12 people to begin with, DeTroyo says basic permitting and inspection activity has suffered. Only the absolutely essential work is getting done. Perhaps the most graphic impact is being felt at the DEC lab in Douglas. Director Raleigh Grab says, "We're just going crazy down here." He says he's working nights and weekends analyzing water samples from Prince William Sound, as well as those from a host of other smaller spills around the state. And DEC's regional offices are also hard hit, giving up major portions of their staff to the spill effort. In Fairbanks, Regional Supervisor Pete McGee says for a while, half his staff was gone. Now he's missing only about a third of his people. As a result, a lot isn't getting done. Water and sewer plans aren't getting reviewed. Inspections for septic systems aren't getting done. Staff for inspecting the miners is cut by two-thirds. The one person assigned to inspect underground fuel storage tanks is gone to Valdez. DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso says for an agency that has never had enough money to fulfill its duties, it's remarkable how well DEC is coping. But he admits that an awful lot is getting put on the back burner.
Making sure that water quality is protected is one. Handling air quality permits is another. It takes a lot of time, and when we have people on our staff that are having to deal with spill, it takes away the time that we would otherwise be spending on what was already a backlog even before the spill happened.
Some relief is on the way. Federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Marine Fisheries Service have offered to transfer some personnel into temporary state service, partly to help with the spill response and partly to backfill those DEC positions lost to the oil spill effort. EPA Steve Torok says his office and DEC are finalizing an agreement that will make it easier to transfer staff and determine who will pay their salaries and expenses. In some areas, like air quality and seafood inspection, that will help significantly. In others, like water sampling experts for the lab, the help simply can't be found right now. There are large pots of money appropriated by the legislature to deal with this oil spill, but there are already more than enough requests to spend that money on immediate spill costs. Kelso says indirect costs like the crippling of an agency's day-to-day work probably won't be eligible.
We don't think that money is going to be available at all for covering other functions that we just weren't able to do because we had to put those people on the spill. And that's really leaving a big hole, not only in our department, but in others as well. We don't see any way right now of getting those costs covered, except that we have not dropped the idea that Exxon really should pay for those things, because those are services that Alaskans would have gotten had we not ended up having to divert those staff and that money to dealing with the spill.
DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
It seems to me that what we've done is make a major public policy decision based on post-oil spill rhetoric, on an emotion that's oriented towards punishing the oil industry, rather than basing that decision on the long-term interest of Alaskans.
Well, there wasn't any way the government could have known that unless ARCO came forward and told us about it, and then we could have fixed it.
According to Arctic National Wildlife Refuge manager Don Vohr, a full field season of ecological research is underway aimed at determining what impacts might result from oil activity there. Included is a study of how exploration work done 5 years ago affected the Arctic environment. This weekend, two Democratic congressmen, Representatives Stephen Solars of New York and Chet Atkins of Massachusetts, will be touring the refuge. Sunday, they'll be looking at the Prudhoe Bay and Endicott oil fields. With U.S. oil exports up almost 10% in April, interest in Arctic oil, and ANWR in particular, appears to be moving slowly off the back burner. Mike Lane, McGrath.
We're very happy to hear the government come out and say that they're going to institute something to protect the community's interests. We had the VPSO from Port Graham there, and he was very pleased with the governor's visit and his statements of commitment to the small communities.
And because of the recent increases in state taxes, ARCO Alaska has been forced to drop several projects that have been very important projects to us. Our WESAC project has been suspended.
My guess is that what they thought was that the bill never was going to pass anyway, so why address the details?
We've had to depend on ourselves and will continue to do so. We would hope that Exxon would see fit to help us out in this issue, and we're happy that the governor's made a commitment to stand with us. So it's Alaskans working together that's going to solve this, with or without Exxon.
During Friday's Emergency Services Council meeting, Kodiak City Mayor Bob Brody held up pages of two Anchorage newspapers for all to see.
This was the headline last night in the Anchorage Times. Was the lead item is Kodiak crew lands first oiled halibut. And there's about two paragraphs talking about oiled halibut. It's rumored that a quarter of the 40,000 pounds was oiled. And then it goes on to talk about just general fishing interests. So that was quite disturbing. Today's Daily News had an article on it back in the Metro section, and it says DEC says halibut untainted. So the first press you get is always the one that gets everybody's attention, and then maybe the real story gets kind of back billing.
The first article, written by a Seattle Times reporter, said a fourth of one vessel's 40,000-pound halibut catch was contaminated by oil. However, by Thursday afternoon, laboratory tests by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation proved the Times article wrong. Colleen Berg of the DEC says an inspector was notified as soon as a crew member thought he saw oil on some of the halibut.
Now, after that, the prudent way to do business is to let DEC inspectors meet the boat, observe the catch. In this instance, the inspector did not visually observe oil, nor did he smell oil, and actually those are two very accurate ways of determining contamination in fish. But he took the additional step to send samples into the Palmer lab for analysis, both of a few of the fish that the crew believed may have encountered contamination and fish that were already in the ship's hold that were not in that area. So, and both sets of samples did not show any contamination at all. So that is the accurate report.
Berg says the best way to obtain accurate information on potentially tainted fish is to let the DEC follow through with the inspection process. A Seattle attorney for a Kodiak processor was listed as the source of the Times article. In Kodiak, I'm Matt Miller.
The mayors from a dozen coastal communities are sending a letter to Exxon. Bob Brody, chairman of the Oiled Mayors, says they're going back to the document they started with in trying to come to an agreement on how to pay for oil spill expenses.
We voted unanimously to resubmit our original offer because it seems like there's been so many different versions of agreements going around, the point has been lost. And our original agreement was very simple and very direct about what our concerns were.
Major concerns included advance payment of oil spill costs to municipalities and reimbursement for straight-time employees who have had to let their regular duties slide so they could work on issues rising from the oil spill. The mayors presented their version of an agreement as a coalition, united in their requests for action. Proposed agreements have been shuttling between the mayors and Exxon for weeks. Each has been combed by lawyers as Exxon and the municipalities tried to compromise. Words have been plucked out and examined carefully for all possible shades of meaning. The results became more and more frustrating to the mayors.
They would tell us something, and we would go write down what we thought we heard and present it to them. And then when we show up to meet, they have completely rewritten the document we have sent so that it didn't even resemble what was originally thought.
Exxon's community liaison manager, Monty Taylor, says it's his understanding that the latest version addressed the mayor's concerns, but it still wasn't what they had in mind. Monty Taylor.
And the result of the meeting, basically, was that the mayor's
concluded that we were still far enough apart in some areas that an agreement was not real close at hand.
Taylor has sent the latest Exxon version to each town, saying these are the guidelines Exxon will work under. One of the key points is that Exxon wants to work with each town by itself.
Well, we're not going to do advanced funding as a group exercise, but we are going to send people to the towns and talk with them about that. And when they can meet with us with some justification of what they think they need to spend advanced monies on, you know, we'll sit down there with them and try to come to agreement on the items that they are going to spend the money on and the amounts, and we'll make the advance funds available, you know, after we agree that those seem logical.
The mayors are vowing to continue working as a group. Bob Brody says they'd still like to work with Exxon, but right now they're at an impasse and beginning to look at a broader picture.
We tried dealing face-to-face with the people who are responsible for the spill, and they don't seem to be willing to deal with this in the manner that we think we can live with, so we're going to start advocating for state and federal legislation that has specific provisions for small municipalities in dealing with big oil.
Later this month, the mayors will take their concerns into an international arena. They'll be meeting in Valdez to compare notes with the mayors of the towns in France, oiled by the Amoco Cadiz oil spill. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.